Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show,
That's my chainsaw imitation.
It's a very northeastern heavy show, don't you think? The forest of the northeast in New England, Jack McEnany, has written a book called Brush Cat on Trees, the Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America. And it basically chronicles the work of loggers, individual loggers. So this, get your mind wrapped around, like, guys that go out and cut big, humongous trees down in the forest pretty much by themselves, not like big logging companies. So it's a different reality, I think, than what most people think. But he chronicles their work, the kind of the trials and tribulations, the reality of the job, you know, all the different things that impact their livelihood. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, my thought had been prior reading the book that all of New England was owned by corporate lumber companies with huge logging crews that went out there in. It's not true. There's a little bit of that, but most of the New Hampshire in particular, 80% privately owned, mostly loners.
Small or two people going
out there and cutting trees.
Yeah.
One at a time.
Because they're small woodlots. So it's like if you had somebody come on your property, Bob, one guy would come and harvest a certain number of trees smartly.
I did that.
Yeah. And that's what takes place in New Hampshire, rather. So anyway, it's a fascinating story. It was a really good book. We really enjoyed it. So we're going to talk to Jack McEnany about Brush Cat. Stick around.
Yep. And the other subject is a man named Vinny Simeone. He works at an arboretum on Long Island, and he's written a book about winter colors, winter interest, winter bark. Another one of my mantras, I'm always preaching about something in the garden every day. But you have to think ahead a little bit. You have to plant these things in the spring and then enjoy them
in the
winter.
Fall.
Yeah, in the fall, sure.
A lot of these things you can still plant right now
fall.
Since our ground's not
frozen.
It's
a matter of planning for winter beauty outside your house.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that hard to do, and it's not done enough. And by golly, we're going to tell you how to do it.
Sure. He's got some good ideas.
Yep.
So that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, as a writer, I'm probably too deeply involved in metaphors, but I've made a new path in my garden. I like to make new paths. I had a short path that I had to move two trees. Once I did that, that path was gone. So I made a new one. I doubled the size. It kind of leads from my little sitting room area out to an open area. But it's longer, it's better. I use red brick and kind of lavender rock along the path, and I got some old marble steps for slabs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to plant kind of soft yellow plants along this thing. I can't wait to see it. I like to make new paths in life and in gardens, and I've done it.
Good.
That's my metaphor,
Sounds
and I'm sticking
nice.
To it.
All right.
How about the Wishy State? What's up?
Well, in reading Brush Cat as we were traveling, I would from time to time read to Andy interesting little parts, right?
Because
he was driving, which inspired him once we got home to get the chainsaw out, Bob. And, you know, we bought a chainsaw after the storms last year, you know, just because we needed to take our cleanup stuff more seriously. And fortunately, Andy does, in fact, know how to safely use a chainsaw. And we were taking down some dead white pines along the front, you know, by the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to stand in the road to make sure it wasn't going to fall right when a car was coming or whatever.
Good thought.
Fair.
Yeah.
So we tied this old rope, operative word old. I think maybe it was a old laundry line that I found in the barn.
It was hemp? Maybe.
Could have been.
You could have smoked it?
So Andy did all his little wedge cuts. I'm ready to go. And we had tied it to there. And I'm standing in the road pulling. And he keeps yelling, pull, pull. I'm like, I am. Because I had the rope sort of behind my back.
I know what's coming,
I
think.
So I pull, and then the darn thing snaps. I fall right on my, you know what. And the funny thing was our neighbor, Ray, was driving over the hill right when it happened.
Saw the whole thing.
So he saw the whole thing. He's like, I saw you fall right on your, you know what.
We call those gravity checks at home.
Yeah.
And you got to be sure gravity's working at all times.
And of course, the tree, for some reason, fell the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Not at all the direction we were trying to pull it. No damage done, of course. But it does go to show that
it can be dangerous.
I mean, even just little random things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm fine. And I'm a little sore from the fall on my padding. I'm well padded. But,
I think I saw it on YouTube the other day. Was that, your neighbor Ray have a cell phone out, did he?
Oh, that was the most classic part, that he actually came right over the hill to see me fly. Anyway, so yes, we take it very seriously, but from time to time, if that's the only thing that happened, I am thankful for that. Amen. So, indeed. All right. We'll be talking a little bit more about chainsaws and logging in the second part of the show. But for now, we're going to talk about the wonders of the winter landscape.
Yes, we have the perfect guest for that. He's Vinny Simeone, Director of Public Horticulture at the Planting Fields Arboretum State Historic Park in Oyster Bay, New York, and has traveled the nation and the world visiting gardens, and is the author of four books, including The Wonders of the Winter Landscape. He's with us here today to talk about the winter landscape, and Vinny, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what a great resume you have, man. You spent all your adult life traveling around the world, working with plants and some pretty famous people to boot. How did you get into that?
Well, I have actually been interested in gardening and interested in horticulture since I'm very young, since I'm about 12. I've been gardening. And my grandmother and my mother really inspired me to garden. So I've been working with the earth for quite a while.
So how'd those other doors open up for you, Vinny, in terms of working with Alan Armitage and others?
Right.
You know, and really making it, you know, you're not just a backyard gardener by any means, but really making it something that significantly contributes to the plant world.
Well, I really got serious in high school. I started to take classes in high school, and then in college, of course, I got really, really serious. After I got a two-year degree from an agricultural school known as SUNY Farmingdale, mm-hmm. I actually decided to go down to University of Georgia, mainly because it was such a great school, had a great reputation, and Alan and Mike were down there,
sure.
And there was a wider palette of plants to learn, and so I decided to go down there. I had some friends down there as well, and it was really one of the best decisions I could ever have made, because it was a very, very serious and very, very broad education on horticulture.
Kind of the center of it all in terms of perennials and woodies, too, I'd say, with those two.
Yeah, and you were, as a student, you were exposed to all the new stuff coming out, all the new research and all the new plant selections that they were selecting at that time. So it really inspired me to really, my focus and my love is first woody plants, but certainly both woody and herbaceous plants there was so key, that sort of flow of new information.
Sure.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about is attention to detail, which is kind of one of my mantras when I talk about planting. People just go stick your nose up against a tree or a shrub and take a look about it. So talk about that detail inspection, which you indicate is very important.
Well, and you know as well as I do that, you know, life is very fast-paced these days, and people sometimes don't literally stop to smell the roses or stop to smell the witch hazel for that matter.
Right.
And I think that the winter landscape sort of stops you in your tracks, especially when there's a nice, you know, up in the Northeast, we have nice snowy days and nice, you know, quiet days. And you really it just stops you in your tracks and makes you enjoy and recognize this wonderful landscape. And it's essential that you stop and sort of take that all in and look at the details of the landscape, because, you know, winter is not about a big floral display. It's not about, except if it's an individual shrub maybe, but it's more about the broad brush. It's more about the big picture and sort of, you know, surveying the landscape and looking at the overall landscape, but then looking at those tiny details of maybe there's water droplets on evergreen foliage, or maybe there's a witch hazel bud that's about to burst open and
right.
show that beautiful yellow color. So I think it's really looking at the details of the landscape and looking at, you know, when do we really look at bark? We look at bark in the winter, and that's a detail on plants that over and over again, we look at it more in the winter than we certainly do in the summer.
So let's talk about some of that detail then, Vinny. What, and since you mentioned bark, what are some of your favorite plants for that bark interest?
Well, for bark, certainly it's hard to have just one favorite.
Sure.
So I probably will mention
you can list several.
Yeah. We got time.
You can talk about more than one.
I know. I do love dogwoods, for mm-hmm. instance.
Right.
I think dogwood bark, both Coosa dogwood and American dogwood, Cornus florida, are just wonderful in the winter. And we think of them as summer flowering shrubs or trees, rather, and spring blooming trees. But we never really look at them at their bark and their structure, which is very beautiful in the winter. One of my favorite plants in winter is a plant called Heptacodium.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The seven sunflower.
Sure.
Got it.
And that's absolutely wonderful in the winter months.
Right.
It sort of sheds off, and this time of year it has a silvery gray bark, and that's just a wonderful plant in the winter. And Parodia is another wonderful plant, I think,
yep.
for us, that does really well and has that beautiful multicolored bark to it that is just so beautiful. So those are just a few of many that I think are great in the winter. And probably my most favorite plant in the winter is Stewardia.
Oh, yeah.
I've never met a Stewardia I didn't like.
Yeah.
And especially in winter, they're just so unbelievable.
It's almost like a good, what's down south everywhere?
Crepe Myrtle?
Crepe Myrtle. Yeah, it's almost Myrtle, like a Crepe Myrtle for north.
Yep.
Yeah, well, Vinny, you mentioned dogwoods. Let's talk some about the red twig dogwoods, because they're coming in now with just a wide variety of colors, yellows and oranges and reds, and they just are stunning in the landscape when properly used.
Yeah, and they really are wonderful winter shrubs. We sort of forget about them in the growing season because they don't do much. They do have an interesting creamy white flower, but it's not overwhelming. And then all of a sudden in the fall and the winter, when they sort of, I call their branches sort of, they have a ripening effect. They sort of turn from green to whatever color they're going to ultimately be. And they are quite nice. And if they're used effectively in the landscape in a mass planting, I think they can be quite beautiful. I really enjoy, the straight red twig dogwood, which is Cornus sericea, is a beautiful one. And there's some new varieties like Cardinal, which is a deep red, Bailey Eye, which is a deep red. And then there's some yellows that are out there that are new yellows, like Bud's Yellow, which is a good one, and has shown some good color to it and good performance. One of my favorites is one that's more of an orangey yellow. It's almost a cross between a red and a yellow, and it's sort of an orangey yellow, is Winter Flame, also known as Midwinter Fire.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's Cornus sanguinea, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that one has done really, really well for us, very vigorous plant, and has sort of a two-tone effect to it that I really enjoy. So I think all of those varieties, all those new ones are, I mean, there's so many new ones coming out, too. And you can even use them in concert with each other. It works really well.
And you can take cuttings and take them inside. So talk about that a little bit.
They work great in the winter for decorations. We use them for decorations all the time, and you can just stick them in the ground even in a pot. Mm-hmm. And you can put a whole display in a pot, and very often they actually root.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, very often they actually root. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Then deciduous hollies, of course, are another favorite here, too.
Yes. Winterberry holly, Ilex verticillata, and all the cultivars work real well for us, and some of the hybrids work extremely well for us. Probably one of my favorites is Red Sprite, which is sort of a semi-dwarf, very large-fruited one. But even some of the yellow ones, like Winter Gold is a wonderful plant, and some of the other yellows are pretty good. But I really enjoy the winterberry hollies, to me, are almost more effective than the evergreens, because you lose those leaves in the fall, and all of a sudden you have this just incredible display of berries. And the berries are also very coveted by birds, so you'll actually attract birds into the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So one of the things I think I've always enjoyed about winter is being able to see the skeleton of trees. Do you know what I mean? Like, really, it's just very architectural, or, I don't know, just such a beautiful natural art form somehow.
Yep.
Are there particular trees that stand out for you in the winter landscape that do have that striking sculptural quality to them, just, you know, all bare and revealed before us?
Oh, there's so many. I think Japanese maple is certainly one that comes to mind, because it has that beautiful, smooth, silvery gray bark, and then the structure of the plant, both the straight species and also the cut leaf forms that have that weeping form, I think are wonderful. There are some wonderful viburnums that we enjoy in the winter. I mean, even Viburnum siboldii, or some of the larger viburnums, I think can have that wonderful structure to them in the landscape. And I go back to Parodia again. Parodia is a wonderful structural plant in the winter, which has sort of a nice upright form to it and is usually multi-stem, so that has some nice structure to it as well. But one of my favorite plants in the winter, at Planting Fields, we have some mature Camperdown elms, weeping elms.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And in the winter months, when they, especially after a snow, they're bare. They're sort of glisten in the winter, and they sort of sway, you know, with the wind, and they are just absolutely stunning.
Hmm. Yeah, one of my joys in the winter, too, are ornamental grasses with a little bit of snow on them.
Yep.
Do you have any favorites in that area?
Yeah, we just actually put an ornamental grass garden in. And we focused on native grasses. We see a lot of the miscanthus and the other grasses, penicetums, but we're actually focusing on native grasses. And some of the panicums, the switchgrasses, are absolutely wonderful. Little blue stem and big blue stem, we're growing a lot of those now, and they have really been terrific for us in the landscape. So we're trying some new native grasses, and there's so many varieties of these grasses as well that they really work well. But we don't bother cutting the grasses down until spring because we want to keep them there all winter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And as you said, as they catch the snow, or even the way they rustle in the winter wind is quite beautiful. But panicums and andropogon are two that I really love that are native grasses.
So, Vinny, too, it's like if we think about You know, you were talking about the, you know, looking at the detail of things and just like really noticing the landscape, stopping to smell the roses, so to speak. Yep. I think we can notice more things as well in terms of nature because of what goes to these plants for shelter,
yeah,
for food, that sort of thing. Is there something that you that stands out to you in terms of how the winter landscape interacts with nature as well, sort of sustains nature?
Actually, two things. The first thing, we mentioned winterberry holly, which, as I mentioned, is a big food source for birds, mm-hmm. especially robins and cardinals. Mm-hmm. And I have a big winterberry holly outside the window of my house. And in the winter, on a nice sunny day, you'll see just a whole flock of birds come in, and they will start feeding on the berries of those hollies. And the whole entire plant is just covered with birds, and it sort of makes you feel good that, you know, that not only is the plant ornamental, but it's also functional in some way. And so that's kind of interesting to see how, and of course this plant is only about 10 feet from my house, so I get to really see up close these birds, you know, enjoying those berries. The other thing is, evergreen cover is extremely important for raptors and certain types of birds of prey, like, great horned owls, screech owls, red-tailed hawks, and so we have these stands of pine trees, white pine, and, even spruces, Norway spruce, that the, raptors will nest in and hunt in, basically, mm-hmm. and use for cover in the winter. So when you see a great horned owl that's got a wingspan of, you know, 3 feet or so,
it's pretty moving, huh?
Winter landscape, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And we have some shrubs near our bird feeder, too, that provide, even when the berries are gone, the leaves are gone,
yep.
they provide some shelter for the birds as they flip back and forth from the shrub to the feeder to the shrub to the feeder.
Yep.
Something else to think about.
But yeah, they're also it's also offering physical cover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely.
And then conifers, nothing prettier than green in the winter. Talk about some of your favorite conifers and how to use them.
My two favorite, I have many favorite conifers, but my two or three favorites. I love Oriental spruce, Picea orientalis.
Oh yeah.
I think it's such an elegant, one of the most elegant trees, evergreen trees that's available. And it's so diverse. It'll take, you know, the heat of the south. It'll take the cold of the north. And it's just such a diverse plant. Lacebark pine, Pinus spongiana,
right.
mm-hmm. which also has exfoliating bark, so uh-huh. it has bark interest in the winter, as well as that evergreen cover. And a plant that I'm trying to really promote amongst the professionals in the trade is the western arborvitae, Thuja plicata.
Oh, yeah.
Because for us up north, it's an important plant for not only evergreen cover and replacing some of the things like overused Leyland cypress or overused cryptomeria or overused American arborvitae, but it's also deer-resistant, and yeah. so that's becoming a big issue up here in the north.
Mm-hmm. One other thing, people go to the nurseries in the spring, and they buy what they see, and it's in color. They don't think about the winter landscape. Isn't now the time to do that and to start planning for next year? And how do you recommend they do that, besides reading your book, of course, The Wonders of the Winter Landscape? Which...
Well, you know, I think at this point, all you can really do is enjoy what you have. I think the planning stage should happen over the winter. For next year, you're absolutely right. I think at least trying to put a list together of plants that you really enjoy and that you want to acquire for your garden is what you can do right now. I think planting in the spring for next year is important. I think, you know, sort of getting the plant together now and then implementing it in the spring and getting the plants that you want in your garden and putting, of course, the right plants in the right place. So the specimen, you know, goes in a certain area or the mass planting around the front door goes in a certain area. And then, again, implementing it in the spring with the idea that over the next couple of years, these plants are going to need some time to mature and time to establish. And then, you know, I think that the plants in the winter, once they get going, once they get established, you're going to have years and years and years of interest and of benefits in that if it's planned right.
Or visit places like the Planting Fields Arboretum in Oyster Bay, New York, and take a look.
Yes, and of course, botanical gardens are a great place to get ideas. So
yeah,
homeowners or gardeners, professionals, we get a lot of people that come in, and we'll get inspired by certain things, certain displays you might put together, or certain individual plants that are here. And it doesn't mean that in 2 years you're going to have a 50-foot-tall oriental spruce, but it's something to aspire to over the next, you know, decade or so, that, to have this plant that's going to really establish itself and give you years and years of interest. So gardening is a long-term commitment, and it's something that will give you a different benefit each year.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it and inspired
thank
some
you.
People to get out there and plant some winter plants.
That's right.
Terrific.
Thanks, Vinny.
Thank you.
Vinny Simeone is Director of Public Horticulture at Planting Fields Arboretum State Historic Park in Oyster Bay on Long Island in New York. For more information on the park or Vinny or his book, The Wonders of the Winter Landscape, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Jack McEnany and Brush Cat on Trees, the Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America is coming up after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And on to Brush Cat, a most fascinating story about what loggers, small, individual, contracted, self-employed loggers do in the woods, the forests of New Hampshire. Yeah, Bob?
And a very complex problem and situation, too.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, there's a lot going on there that we need to look at and think about. Solve some of the world's problems.
I mean, honestly, you know what I mean? It is kind of like one of those snapshots of one thing that we've screwed up royally because of consumerism and other
things. Among many.
Anyway, Jack McEnany is joining us now. He's a writer who has lived in New Hampshire among loggers for over 20 years. He's brought their unique story to life in his book, Brush Cat, on Trees, the Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America. He's joining us from his home in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Jack, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Before we get into it, since we've read the book, we know what you're talking about when you talk about a logger. But I think a lot of people think about logging in that more kind of large-scale, mechanized sort of way.
In a corporate sense.
In a corporate sense. And this is not, I mean, that was what sort of surprised me, too. This is not at all what's happening in the northern forests and in New England. It's almost an individual pursuit. You're self-employed and at the whim of, so many different factors. So kind of give us a snapshot of what and who a logger is in the great northern woods.
Well, you're an independent contractor, so you have to be, a highly motivated person. Most of what gets done around here for logging is done in the dead of winter. The colder, the better, because you do less damage to the woods that way. The leaves are off the deciduous trees, so you can see through the forest much better to see, where you have to go and how to lay a skid road down. The problem with it is that it's sort of the economics of the situation have forced people into becoming these lone wolves out in the woods. They can't afford to hire anyone anymore because the margins are so close.
Okay.
There used to be 40 mills around here. There are now four. So you can imagine what that's done to competition. So they're just sort of stuck working in the woods by themselves. And, you have to be a very confident person, someone who isn't afraid. In honesty, I'm afraid of that chainsaw. I'm just doing it out here. And whenever I use it, I always want somebody else around. I never use it if there isn't someone else home.
Right.
Just this past week, an off-duty police officer here in New Hampshire had the chainsaw, jump up on him. He was cutting firewood, jump up on him, hit him in the neck, and he died. He bled out before 911 could get to him.
Yeah, among the many things I learned from your book was, 80% of the land in New Hampshire is privately owned. I'd assumed it was just all nothing but logging companies, and that the average pay of a logger for all this work has dropped from, $60,000 a year to $30,000 a year. And I think more important, the actual short time span they're allowed to go in the woods and log. You can't do this year-round.
No, right. You have to make your money while, make hay while the sun shines.
Like, what, 3 months a year is all they get?
Between global warming and the shorter winter that we're seeing, maybe it isn't global warming, maybe it's something else, but the winters are demonstrably shorter. And then wood from the Philippines, wood from Siberia, wood from Canada is all flooding the market. And again, big problem. NAFTA did not treat the loggers well, and GATT treated them worse. So that's where we are with loggers. There used to be probably 3,000 independent loggers in New Hampshire. I'm not sure. There are now about 1,000.
So, Jack, give us and our listeners a picture in our head in terms of, because you talked about Logger Bob, and he allowed you in and sort of behind the scenes with him, as he would go do his job logging by himself, essentially. So tell, describe a situation a scenario. What did he have to do in order to, you know, fell a really big tree and then get it to a lumber yard to be processed and to be paid?
Right. So the first thing he'd have to do is to cut a skid row into the woods so that he could cut the trees and then drag them out with his skidder, which is just a sort of a big tractor. It's got a small blade in the front of it and a knuckle in the middle of it, so it can take really tight corners, get around trees, get around boulders in the woods.
Okay.
It's really fun to drive. Everybody would want one if you ever tried it. So the first thing you have to do is cut these skid rows, there's a lot more to that than you'd think, because, you know, nothing's flat around here. It's all mountainous. There are these giant glacial boulders everywhere, and actually getting the trees you want off a piece of property can be a real chore. So this is the first thing he does, and then he cuts trees. And what he does is he uses a method where he cuts the tree and leaves it with a hinge on it, and he'll go and do another one and do another one and do another one.
Oh, like a domino.
And then
he'll
go back and cut them, and they go down like dominoes.
Oh.
He also take care of snags in the woods like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, see, what is as dangerous as the chainsaw is, the thing that makes logging the most dangerous job in the country is not the chainsaw, but the trees themselves. That's how most loggers get killed. Trees fall on them.
Right.
Other, you know, weekend people, hobbyists, inexperienced loggers, you know, they get the huge sucking wounds from the chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, you know, tends to, a tree just falls in a way that no one could have predicted because maybe the hardwood was rotten or there was, you know, something, or it bounced off a snag and bounced back at you or the butt end kicked up at you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's generally the tree that kills you. And then he'll chain up a hitch. And that's basically grabbing the log and putting the chain around it, dragging it up to the next log, getting that in the hitch, and getting as many of these,
okay,
depending on how big the tree is, and dragging as many of them as he can out to the landing.
Down the skid row thing.
Down mm-hmm. the skid row. And again, you know, it's for danger. I mentioned in the book this fella who was driving the skidder, and he turned around to look at the hitch to see, make sure everything was all right. Yeah, and it's kind of touchy to do that. You don't want to bark the younger trees as you're going by them because you want to leave them and come back in 10 years or 5 years or whatever and cut them down too. So you have to, in order to do it sustainably, you have to do it with as little damage to the other trees and the landscape as possible, which is, you know, it takes a deft hand. So this fellow was looking back at the hitch, making sure that it wasn't doing something it shouldn't have been doing. And the bear claw chain that goes around the giant skidder tires picked up a stick and just jammed it right into his eye and took the eye out as he's driving along.
Oh.
You know, I mean, it's just
a freak
there's just
thing
so
like
many
that,
things
yeah.
that can go wrong in the woods.
Yeah.
But they're constantly thinking about this. They're vigilant in their minds. They don't seem like nervous people, but
they've got to be. Yeah.
They should be.
Yeah, you really spoke to that well, you know, the stereotype of the logger versus, you know, the very smart people, very careful people. And they're working in 20 and 30 below zero, often in heavy winds. And it is, the insurance tables prove it is the most dangerous job in the United States.
Right.
Without a doubt.
Hmm. Right.
It's just amazing.
Twice as dangerous as commercial fishing. Certain kinds of commercial fishing, like the crab fishing up in the Bering Straits, the Bering Sea, is more dangerous. But that's just one type of fishing. And the Bering Sea isn't in the United States anyway, so.
Yeah. So there you go.
Also, there are some areas that are being clear-cut versus the selective logging for a 20-year cycle, perhaps. Talk about the war between those two theories of logging.
Well, part of the problem is that now with the mechanized systems, if you buy used equipment, it would cost you a couple of million dollars to start. Just a medium-sized mechanized logging operation. So just moving that equipment, because some of it's so big, is an expensive chore. So when you get someplace, you know, the tendency is to cut as many trees as possible. The equipment is sort of big and logy in the woods and barks a lot of trees, so you cut them down anyway. And that's the problem with these mechanized operations is that, you know, for a couple of reasons, they take too many trees. We don't have the largest clear cut that's legal here in New Hampshire is 40 acres, which is a pretty big piece.
Right.
It's 40 acres. It's probably somewhere around 2 million square feet. But out west, you'll see 300-acre clear cuts, which are like a scab on the earth, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Horrible thing.
And if it's not reforested, you know, all kinds of weird invasive species can move in, and you get a bad crop the second time around. Mm-hmm. Nothing can come back from three clear cuts, though. If you take too much of the tree away, it leaves no understory. The trees, you know, the trees fall down, they rot, and they become soil. And if you three times in a row cut it away, cut it away, cut it away, you've created a piece of dead earth there. Mm-hmm.
But the idea of sequestration of certain forests so that they are this carbon or CO2 kind of neutral zone, right? Mm-hmm. Popular in California, and it works in California, probably wouldn't work in New Hampshire, but talk about the concept of logging, but also preserving, etc., that there's this carbon neutral thing that's happening, or CO2 neutral thing that's happening, that's not happening when we use other types of fuels.
Right. Well, here in New Hampshire, we have two large electricity producing plants. One is a 50 megawatt wood chip fired plant. The other is a coal fired plant. That coal fired plant represents 20% of the entire state's carbon footprint. That one energy producing plant. So it makes a big difference. You know, wood chips aren't the best use of wood for energy. They fire it with propane, so there's a carbon footprint there. But you only capture about 25% of the energy in the wood chip. 75% goes out as heat. So unless you're capturing the heat and using it to heat buildings. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, goes on quite a bit here now as well, and those systems are set up at individual sites, institutionally at schools and town halls, and some office buildings have a wood chip or wood pellet cogen plants that are producing electricity and heat, which is, you know, really interesting and a great use of the wood. Sequestration around here, because most of the land is owned by small landowners like me, 25 acres or less. You know, you have to sequester 500, 1,000, 5,000 acres to use the.
So you'd have carbon, to figure out a collective thing.
Credit.
Uh-huh.
So you know, you would need hundreds of different contracts with mm-hmm. hundreds of different landowners. So you know, it's probably not a good idea for around here. And the whole thing with carbon sequestration is, and this is a sort of a problem with what goes on out in California, is that they're giving the credits for trees that have already grown. You know, mature trees really aren't using much carbon anymore.
So it's the young forest that would be most effective.
Young forest, exactly. And a young forest in a warm place, not a temperate place like here, young trees around here only grow about 4 months out of the year. That's when they will suck up some carbon. Down in the rainforest, however, which really needs to be reforested, trees grow year-round. And a single tree, which you can plant for anywhere from a dime to or anywhere, a penny to a dollar, will eat up 50 pounds of carbon a year until it becomes mature. Mm-hmm. So that's what that you know.
So that's the argument for it, and the fact that it's a renewable resource.
I sometimes think they're double counting when they give carbon credits for mature trees.
If you're too old,
but I tell people that the best way to encapsulate some carbon is to get some local spruce and fir and. Uh-huh. And mill it up and build a house and take really good care of that house, and you will have sequestered a lot of carbon.
Yeah. The economy all over the place impacts how wood's being used, whether there's, you know, supply and demand is high or low or whatever, right? So that's going to dictate how much money the loggers get.
Right.
But now we're shifting to sort of the scrubby pulp stuff. We don't use as much paper. Is that true? Or there are just not as many paper plants up your way? So they're trying to figure out other uses for the pulp wood?
Right.
Is that part of it?
Yes. There used to be, you know, several large paper plants up in Berlin and Groveton, New Hampshire. They're gone. There's one small plant up there owned by a Canadian company. They don't take many contracts. They're still in business. They have, you know, a reduced workforce. So, right. So there are thousands of acres of these pulpwood trees, and there's not much good for anything. They don't have a lot of BTUs in them for feedstock for wood chips, although I'm sure they will use them because they're talking about 300 to 500 megawatts in the North Country alone, which will eat up a lot of wood chips. And again, because it's all LNG fired gas, you know, they use a lot of carbon, and they don't really use all of the energy out of the wood chips. A better use of wood for power is cellulosic ethanol, which uses an enzyme to break down the wood biologically, break down the wood to create the sugars and ultimately create ethanol out of trees, out of other substances too, like switchgrass.
Sure.
But we're finding out that
that's 85% of the they get 85% of the energy out of the wood chip by using it.
So it maximizes what energy you get. Yeah.
Would that be more efficient than corn ethanol, which is now a controversial program?
Oh, it's much more efficient. If you using this this biologic process, it's 13 times more efficient than corn-based ethanol, because as we know, you know, it takes 1.3 gallons of oil to create 1 gallon of corn-based ethanol. And if you wanted to fill up your tank completely with corn-based, say 20 gallons of corn-based ethanol, it takes enough corn to feed a person on a 2,000 calorie a day diet for a year to make one tank of ethanol.
And we don't eat wood, do we?
Well, Jack, you mentioned in your book the town of Berlin, New Hampshire, and then as kind of the microcosm of where the towns are going in the logging industry. And, of course, the loggers themselves are less than they were. What's the future here? What do you see 10 years from now?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that these other, wood-to-energy technologies take hold and that it revitalizes the wood economy, the forest economy up there. There are other processes that are becoming more viable commercially, such as they can take wood and reduce it to its essential hydrocarbons and then reconstitute it into plastics. And this has been going on forever. I mean, celluloid film was, made out of trees. We've been making plastics out of wood for a long time. But now we have a reason to, because it completely takes petrochemicals out of the equation. You can make anything you want to make out of plastic, and you don't have to use any oil at all. Huh. So, that's going to become more and more
important. That's a niche
important.
For it right there, yeah.
Also, as we reach peak oil and gas gets more expensive, transporting something, with the mass of lumber is going to become prohibitively expensive. So we'll see, I hope, fewer imports from the Philippines and from Russia, and maybe even fewer from places like Wisconsin. And with, like the locavore movement where people are eating locally, maybe we could start building our houses out of locally cut and milled wood. Mm-hmm. I would think that as energy prices rise, it's going to become a necessity.
Well, one silver lining I found in your book was there are actually more trees in this country than there were 100 years ago.
Yeah, and this forest, even, at the height of the housing market, and they were building houses, faster than you could count them, it was still what they call a producing forest, which means at the end of the year, there were more trees growing in it than had been growing in it the year before.
Right.
So, yeah, I have to beat back the forest constantly around here. It just encroaches on, the 4 acres that I have.
I guess we could still blow it, certainly, and disrupt that balance of more trees actually growing, because we have to allow the trees to catch up with us after all, right?
We do. But we should keep in mind there are so many facets to this. You poke it anywhere and it pops out somewhere else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The albedo of trees. The sun beats down on trees in the wintertime, okay, and the trees absorb that warmth, that radiation, adding to global warming, adding to the ambient temperature. However, if you were to cut all those trees down and there was a field of snow, that snow would reflect the sunlight.
Right.
So, depending upon where you are and what the circumstances are, a well-managed forest can be anything from clear cuts of some size, which is good for habitat, good for deer, good for the brown-tailed bunnies becoming extinct up here because it likes little clearings, or not touching it at all, not touching it at all and letting it grow. And the forest, we have a new forest plan here, and the Sierra Club is very much against where they're cutting some trees, these giant old oak trees that two people couldn't get their arms around are now being harvested in the National Forest. And that's, I think, too bad. And as Bob, I ran into Bob the Lark the other day, and he said, yeah, well, too bad for you. He said they really are beautiful trees and they shouldn't be cut. He said, but, I don't have access to that. I can't go in the National Forest and cut because I don't have the insurance that they want. I'm not a mechanized logger. So I'm out here cutting regular oak trees, and the mills don't even want them. They said, you can keep those, Bob. We should see what we're getting from, you know, the subsidized logging operation over in the national forest.
Subsidized.
What a complex issue this is.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because in the when you log in the national forest, the Forest Service cuts the skid rows, which is a big piece of time and and resources that.
And then the mechanized equipment comes in and takes over. It is a complicated issue, and I suppose it won't ever get uncomplicated. But thank you for bringing it to such a good story.
Yep.
You bring characters and people and real lives and real issues to the table. Well, thank you, Jack.
Including getting lost in Robert Frost Woods, which
That's
I really
right.
almost envy you that trip.
We'll save you getting lost in your own woods for you got to read the book to see what happens
right.
to Jack. How about that?
That's great.
All right. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks, Bob.
Jack McEnany is a writer who has lived in New Hampshire among loggers for over 20 years and has brought their unique story to life in his book, Brush Cat on Trees, The Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America. Jack is also the co-author of Bodie, Go Fast, Be Good, Have Fun, the autobiography of skier Bodie Miller. For more information on Brush Cat and Jack, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a couple of questions.
Yes, indeed.
First from Miss Wishy.
All right.
A man named Mark, it's an interesting question and maybe no answer for it. He has grown pineapple sage this summer, which is zone 8 to 11, like Florida and South by and large. He's got two plants in his garden. He wants to save them for next year or find a way to propagate them or grow them to have the same plant next year. Is that possible in good old Louisville, Kentucky?
Yeah, and I think he was curious about like little microclimates as well, because he's got a west-facing area that he wants to plant them.
Right.
And sometimes you can find little microclimates outside to get these tender perennials to winter over, but a west-facing one is not one of those.
No.
A south-facing up close to the house is you know, you've got some chance there because it stays warmer, but the west does not. The west gets the coldest part of the winter weather, so that's, I'm inclined to say, you're not going to have a microclimate outside to help you. So instead, take some soft wood cuttings, because those types of sages usually get kind of woody in nature, and take some of cuttings from a softer, newer growth and stick those with a rooting hormone and then into like perlite or vermiculite, something light, until they root out. And then you can transplant them into like little peat pots and just try to have like a little collection of perennials that you've taken cuttings of. Get them through the winter, put them in an eastern or southern facing window inside, and then you can plant them out in your location, you know, next spring. But you're not going to be able to, like, take cuttings and keep them in a vase or anything like that until, you know, next spring. You will have to get those rooted out promptly after you take the cuttings.
I've seen elaborate little greenhouse things where they dug a hole 3 feet in the ground like a pit and put plastic over it, and sometimes plants will survive, but your solution is much easier.
Yeah.
Than the other way to go.
Yeah, and then you'll have more plants to work
right.
with as well. And honestly, if you do have if you have a location on the south side of the house that's sort of warm, you could try to transplant those salvias to that location and use those as your stock plants. You know what I mean?
Nothing to lose.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. All right, Bob, here's one for you. This has another hardiness suggestion.
Yeah.
But this one's from Becky Kruger. She lives in Orange County in southern Indiana. Will pomegranate trees flourish here, she asks?
Oh, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
Next question.
Flourish would be the operative
yeah, right.
no part of it.
Yeah, they need a much more warmer climate. And as we talked earlier, I've never seen one here, which is an indication that it's not going to happen. If you had a greenhouse situation, perhaps, because there'll be small trees.
Mm-hmm.
There are shrub-sized plants that may not get the fruit that you want.
Right.
So I'm afraid
it just doesn't. It won't work here.
If you haven't seen it, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. I had when I lived in Tucson, Bob. I had 4 pomegranate trees in my backyard.
Oh man,
pretty cool, huh? And I would harvest them and eat the pomegranates.
Do you miss them?
I have other things that have replaced the wonderfulness of them. How about that?
I hear you.
Yeah.
Good political answer.
Yeah.
If you have a pomegranateless question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246 or get those Christmas cards in here at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
A question for you first, Miss Wishy.
Okay.
If I mentioned to you a plant called Zea, Z-E-A, maize, M-A-Y-S,
mm-hmm.
Do you know what I was talking about?
Yeah.
What?
Corn.
Doggone it.
Who do you think you're talking to, man?
I know. I knew you'd have that. What if it was Zea maize populus basketballus? What would that be?
Then that would be you eating popcorn,
exactly.
Watching TV.
Why am I doing this? We've been together too long, kiddo. That's what it is. We're going to talk about popcorn.
All right.
Because I cannot watch basketball.
Without popcorn. That's how daddy
Or I go to a movie at $45 a gallon a bucket and drink the stuff. But yeah, Zea is Latin for grain. Maize, and it's spelled actually M-A-Y-S, is Latin for corn.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the popcorn. It was thousands of years ago when Native Americans first discovered us. Wouldn't that be kind of fun to sit around a fire and... And some people thought the popping sound was an angry god escaping the kernel. Why not? Popcorn became very popular in the Great Depression because there was no money and no sugar and no food. They used to cook it in straight lard.
Delicious.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
Pick it off as it exploded. And it pops because the outer hull of the seed is hard, impervious to moisture.
And the moisture inside.
Yeah, the kind of dense starch inside. It takes 135 pounds per square inch of heat to blow that kernel up, at least 180 degrees. And bam, you get popcorn. The popcorn popping machine was invented by a Charles Creeters in 1885. It was a steam-driven contraption containing one-third butter, two-thirds lard. Unbelievable. And the operator was a guy called the Toasty Roasty Man.
Toasty Roasty?
He was the popcorn guy. The Chinese have a machine that pops it all at once. Can you imagine that?
Like one foul
bam.
Pop, and
all
it's done.
Boom, you got all your popcorn, yeah. And what are the old kernels called, you know?
The old kernels?
The ones that don't pop.
The ones that don't?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Old maids.
Huh.
Didn't know that.
Didn't either.
Doesn't matter the color of the corn. It's always white inside. Has a great smell. You cannot miss a popcorn smell.
Mm-hmm.
The nutritional value is zip. It's high in fiber, low in fat, no sodium or sugar. Then the world's biggest popcorn ball. This was fun. One last little fact for you. The town of Sac City, Iowa had the Guinness World Record with a 2,225-pound popcorn ball. And somebody else came along and beat the record. So they come back just last fall. And got a 5,060-pound ball of popcorn, 7.5 feet in diameter, 29 feet around.
Hmm.
Amazing.
Isn't it funny how you like almost ruin this perfect fiber food?
Yeah.
You know, no sugar, no salt. And what do we put on it?
Exactly.
A bunch of sugar and salt and
that's
fat.
That's what it takes.
Hmm.
I have a poem.
All right.
Happens to cover it.
Okay.
Do you sometimes wonder, if you wonder at all, which state has the largest popcorn ball? And where would you begin to eat that treat? If the distance around it measured 29 feet. And would you, as a sometimes math student, flinch, knowing it would take 135 pounds to the inch, to blow that beauty way up into space, leaving salt and butter all over your face? Do you sometimes wonder, if you wonder at all, where all those frothy kernels would fall? Or if this is what Charlie Creeters had in mind with a steam-driven popcorn machine design? Do you sometimes wonder, if you wonder at all, how many of us watched basketball or took in a movie at home or aways without an overpriced bucket of Zea maize?
Very good. Yeah, I got to buy Zea maize when I go to the movies, too.
I got all kinds of it.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
You betcha.
It's a good holiday treat, too.
Yeah.
Now you know more about popcorn than you probably ever wanted
to
know.
Exactly.
All right. That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to discuss some holiday ideas, some smart gift giving perhaps, among other things.
Homegrowers, produced by the always popping Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.